Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for being with us this beautiful Monday. We have three great guests joining us today, two of them from Hawaii, but each of them following their own path and doing good work along the way. I'll tell you about my third guest. We'll go in reverse order. My third guest today was living on top of the world and looking forward to more great things to come. But suddenly, as she says in her own words, a wind came and changed everything. A big wind came along and changed everything. Cammie Walker faced huge challenges and still does, but after following the advice of an African medicine woman, she now leads a global giving movement that's active in 38 countries, and we'll find out more about Cammie's story toward the end of the show. My second guest turned her life inside out after 9/11. It made her realize that there was more to life, as it did for many people. And Galen Quinn is now a consultant to social economic development projects in places like the Amazon. And today she's taking us to Hawaii in her latest historical novel. But it's not the same story that James Michener told if you read the book Hawaii way back, I think it was in the 50s. The Last Aloha tells a real story, and it's based on facts that were suppressed for almost 100 years. We'll find out more about that. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Conversations Live Alan Cohen, who coincidentally also lives in Hawaii. He joined us earlier this year on Conversations Live to talk about one of his 22 nonfiction inspirational books. And he's a contributing writer for the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. His work's been featured on Oprah.com, and his books have been translated into 23 languages. He's literally touched the lives of millions of people who found the courage to believe in themselves and follow their dreams. And Alan's following a dream of his own, 12 years in the making. Today he's joining us to talk about Lyndon's Last Life, and I'll bring him on now. Alan Cohen, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be back. Hi, Vicki.
Well, I'm excited for you because I know you're very excited after you've written 22 nonfiction books and now your novel is here and published and making the rounds. And you told me that this was 12 years in the making. And I read that you said, you know, there's always a risk when an author switches from what he's known for, which nonfiction is you, and switching to fiction. But you said it was more of a risk not to write it, more of a risk not to turn to nonfiction. So tell us a little bit about that and what made you make that transition.
You know, Wayne Dyer says that motivation is when you take hold of an idea, and inspiration is when an idea takes hold of you. And I've lived my life mostly by inspiration. And so back in the 90s, I got this image of a young man who was down and out and homeless about to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge when he is stopped by a Buddhist monk who tells him that if you go away like this, you're going to have to come back and it'll be worse. And so I began to write a novel not really knowing where it was going. It was just as if that one scene was given to me and I had to run with the ball. And to my amazement, a novel kind of spun itself as if it was just moving my fingertips on the keyboard. And it turned into a book called Lyndon's Last Life. And I was as amazed by what happened as somebody who might read it. So finally, after 12 years of Lyndon's journey, he's been birthed and he's out there and people seem to be loving it.
Well, I know that many great works have come from within or from a source outside of ourselves. I've talked with many authors over the years, not just for the radio show. I've also talked with screenwriters down in Hollywood who've said that, you know, this thing just came to them and they were compelled to write it. And that's what it sounds like for you.
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned, I've written lots of books and really, I feel like I'm more like a secretary or a recording secretary than an author. I mean, the first time somebody introduced me as an author, I thought, what are you talking about? I just wrote a book, you know? But it was more like the book was given to me and I was passing it along than I was creating it.
So let's take a little look at the book, Lyndon's Last Life. On the back, he's described just as down and out. Lyndon Kozlowski is about to end it all. He's intercepted by a monk who convinces him that if he runs away from life, he'll have to return and his problems will just get worse. I know there's a lot of life lessons in here without being preachy. Give us a brief synopsis of the book in your own words.
Well, Lyndon is told that if he runs away, it'll be worse. And so he has to learn to die with dignity. And he's also told the Buddhist philosophy that the goal of life is to get off the wheel of karma and never have to be reborn into this horrible world again. So he makes a mystical deal to die with dignity and never be reborn, no matter what. And then something happens, which I won't tell you now, that causes him to want to change his mind. But he has set this terrible destiny in motion. So the book really seeks to ask and answer two vital questions that most of us face at one time or another. One is, do I have control of my destiny? If I have set a destiny in motion that may be adverse, is there any way I can reverse it? And second, even more fundamentally, is life really worth living anyway? Are we supposed to be here, or is this some kind of penal colony we're supposed to escape from? So, In addition to being an entertaining book, hopefully, I am hoping to give readers a message that will be life-affirming and remind them that they do have control of their own destiny and not to give it away to outside sources.
Right. Now, one of the, in the book, Lyndon is lying on his hard bed one night and there are thoughts going through his head and he says, did that book dupe me? He's talking about Buddhism. Is Buddhism just a big mind game? Is there anything to reincarnation, or is it just a pleasant tale we fabricate to shield ourselves from the fact that when you're dead, you're dead? So somebody does not have to believe in reincarnation to enjoy this book, I think. What do you think?
Oh, not at all. Reincarnation is just the platform to get people to ask themselves, why are we here, and is life worth living? The book has just been out about a month, but I've received lots of wonderful emails from Christians and non-believers and all kinds of people who are more interested in the fact that they could be uplifted by the message of the book than whether they believe in a particular Hindu philosophy or Buddhist philosophy. So it's really a book for everyone, no matter what spiritual path you happen to be walking.
Right. Now, you believe that, you personally believe that we have a destiny and we have a free will. I wonder, and of course, these are things that are examined in the book through Lyndon's journey. I wonder if you talk a little bit about your beliefs on destiny and free will.
Well, it's really, I'll tell you a short story, which I think will be interesting to you and your readers. A friend of mine was set out to produce her first seminar. She's a coach and motivational speaker. And so she joined with five other speakers, and they decided that, well, they would just each get 10 people to come to the seminar, and it would be a success. Well, about a week before the seminar, they checked in, and she had gotten 20 people to sign up, and the other five people had gotten a total of 5 people. And she said, well, come on, guys. I thought we were going to get people. And one of them said, well, Mercury is in retrograde, so the stars are against us. Another one said, well, the economy is bad. Well, it's your own fear that's causing you to not attract these people. She said, what do you think I should tell them? I said, well, tell them that if Mercury and the economy and fear were so powerful, why did I get 20 people and you got 5? And when the event finally happened, she got 50 people and they got 10. So the point is that we are very prone to give our power away to stars and numbers and economies and histories and karmas and reincarnations and all kinds of things outside of ourselves, when meanwhile intention and focus and free will and choice and creative joy-based decisions actually have the power to create our lives far more than anything that might influence from the outside.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Lyndon's Last Life. My guest is Alan Cohen, and you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Does work feel like a puzzle and you don't know where all the pieces are, or you have all the pieces but you don't know what the picture should look like? Then join me, Denise Rubin, 30-year vet in human resources. I've sat in the boardroom and in the executive offices, and I'll share with you the trials and tribulations of the workplace and how together we can solve the workplace puzzle one piece at a time. Tune in to Work Does Matter, Fridays from 1 to 2 in the afternoon on Alternative Talk 1150. Visit my website at workdoesmatter.com.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Heaven and hell do not exist. If you die, you do so at your own risk.
Welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is author Alan Cohen, and you might remember him from one of his 22 inspirational books that he's written over the years. But his new fiction book has just been released. It's been out about a month, I believe. It's called Lyndon's Last Life. And let's give out the website, Alan, and we'll do it again before we end today. But there is video on there that kind of looks into the book a little, isn't there?
Right. And the website is simply Lyndon's Last Life. Last Life, L-I-N-D-E-N-S, Last Life, all one word, .com, and people can watch what I think is a fascinating 2.5-minute video trailer that demonstrates the story of the book, and we've had lots of great response from that.
Yeah. And I know that from reading some background on you that you used to work in an office and you felt that you were kind of, you know, this isn't what I want to do. I'm not happy here. How much of Lyndon is actually based on you? Because I know a lot of authors do. You know, I have a friend who's a very well-known author, and I can see her constantly throughout her novels.
Sure. Well, let's face it. All fiction is on some level autobiographical. You cannot have an idea that is unrelated to your own life. So, you know, people ask me, well, this is about a guy who wants to commit suicide. Have you ever wanted to do that? I said, well, I never really thought about it as an act, but I realized that there was a time in my life where I was working at a pointless job and really just feeling like my life was not worthwhile. And I really began to wonder, what am I doing here? What is anybody doing here when we live these banal, pointless existences? So in that sense, you know, Lyndon is kind of an extreme expression of something I went through, but actually a literal expression of what lots of people go through.
Mm. What about religion? Because you do cover, you know, we're talking about Buddhism at the beginning of the show. What are your viewpoints on religion and how this fits into Lyndon's last life?
Well, he grew up as a Christian, and he says at one point, I quit Christianity because they tried to scare me with threats of life after death, and now here I am in Buddhism, and they're trying to scare me with threats of eternal life and on Earth. He says, have I really gotten anywhere?
Scared
and
by
so the truth is that I'm not for or against religion. I think religion can really help if you approach it purely and you get to its pure teachings. But like religion, like any organization or institution, has all kinds of trappings of fear and guilt and control and money and punishment and yada, yada. And so my suggestion to folks is that if you're going to participate in a religion, make sure it's in a way that's meaningful and joy-based rather than fear-based. And that's pretty much what Lyndon had to learn through the two religions he went with in the book.
Right, and I read a quote by you. I'm going to read it out. You say, if readers come closer to liberation and farther from oppression, I will consider the book a success. What kind of feedback are you getting on the book right now, Alan?
Well, the main feedback I get is that people can't put it down. They call it a page-turner, and one woman read it in one day with a one-hour break. And so there's something about the book that I believe is life-affirming, and it's speaking to people who are questioning what they're doing with their lives and where is my passion and why do I feel stuck and why do I think that people outside me have power over me and what will it really take for me to take charge of my life. So if it speaks to people at that level and encourages them to claim the power of their own destiny, then I think it's a real success. And it seems to be that's what people are getting, which makes me very gratified.
Mm. I think there are several life lessons in the book. It's described as incorporating adventure, intrigue, romance, pathos, humor, surprises. What do you think is the biggest life lesson? Let's rephrase that. What did you learn when you were writing this? Because I think any time we undertake a project like this, we learn, we have a deeper understanding of things or of ourselves. What was your biggest lesson during this process?
Well, I think it's that love and self-honoring and self-respect supersede all of our personal history. And, I grew up in the Jewish religion, which is, it's a good religion, but in some ways it's guilt and fear-based. I once heard a joke that said that the Jews invented guilt and then the Catholics perfected it. So I grew up in that space feeling like I had done something terribly wrong and I had made some kind of mistake just by being here, and I had to watch out because there were evil forces afoot that were going to get me and get me to pay off my past misdeeds from this life or others. And I've had to learn over the course of many years that just is not true, that no matter what I've done historically, I can make choices in the present that not only offset the history, but forge a way for a brighter destiny. So it's really a critical shift from a sense of guilt and punishment to a sense of power and affirmation and wholeness and joy-based living. That's, I had to go over and over. Every time I did the 100 revisions of the book, I had to remember that lesson. So in a sense, I wrote it for myself, but
right.
There's other people out there who could benefit, then great too.
Right. Now, at the beginning of the segment, you said that the book asks three questions. Can you make a new decision today that can offset unfavorable decisions you've made in the past? What do you think now? Do you believe that?
Well, always. There are people who are dying of diseases that were stress-related and fear-related, and they have an aha that recognizes that, they're here for a good purpose and there's love and joy available to them. And the disease disappears overnight. I've heard of cancers and all kinds of hard diseases that seem incurable that shift and heal when people make a new decision. So absolutely, 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 you can make a new decision that offsets anything that happened in the past.
Mm. And the book also raises the question, do painful experiences come to us by chance for punishment, or are they ultimately a contribution to our success? What's your personal belief on that?
Well, obviously, you can turn anything into a positive if you look at it from the proper perspective. So it's not punishment. It's just something that's trying to get your attention to shift. And if you take a wake-up call like a disease or a bankruptcy or some kind of relationship or a divorce, I know lots of people who said that was the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me to make a course correction to change my life for the better. So it was not a punishment. It was an opportunity.
Mm, may seem like it at the time, but down the road with hindsight, yeah. And the third question, one of the biggest questions it raised was, and I hope we get a resounding yes to this, is life worth living anyway?
Well, I sure hope so, because we're all here. and it really is. I guess one of the biggest lessons of my life has been to move away from a sense of drudgery and obligation to a sense of celebration and creativity. And at that point, when I look at my puppies, I realize that I'm here for a good reason. God is love.
Right, right. So what do you hope ultimately that Well, what would you like to leave our listeners with today? What do you hope that readers of this book will take away with them?
Well, I'd like them to feel more excited about their lives. I'd like them to realize that everything that's ever happened to them has led up to this moment. I'd really like them to realize that in the big picture, there are no real mistakes. We made temporary errors, but ultimately we can parlay any mistake into an opportunity, and that life is really not working against us, but it's actually conspiring in our favor on our behalf.
Sounds good, and it's a good read. Lyndon's Last Life, and you can find more about that at lyndonslastlife.com, correct, Alan?
Correct, L-I-N-D-E-N, yeah.
L-I-N-D-E-N, lyndonslastlife.com. And Alan Cohen, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's been great chatting with you again, Vicky. Take care.
You too. And you can find out more about Alan's other work at alancohen.com. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with Galen Quinn. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's AndreaKay.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Deepak Chopra says, since change is the only constant in life, it helps to have an expert navigate through the ups and downs of life. And coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, our guest is the expert he's referring to. Adrian D. Bonvoisin specializes in navigating change and will discuss the first 30 days and how to make any change easier. We'll also talk with Dr. Susan Albers about 50 ways to soothe yourself without food. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Hear podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Galen Quinn. Her book is called The Last Aloha. And she also lives, I believe she lives in Hawaii. We'll check with that just with her in just a moment. Let me give you a little bit of background on Galen. When she's not writing novels, she works as a consultant to social economic development projects in places like the Amazon, Cambodia, Tanzania, and Austin, Texas. She holds a master's degree in community development and is working on her third book. Her writing reflects her passion for diverse cultures, as well as major world themes affecting personal, social, and spiritual lives. Sorry about that. We copied over the bio, and there was a big old error in there. Didn't make any sense to me. But I'd like to welcome Galen Quinn. The Last Aloha is her book. Hi, Galen.
Yes, aloha from Molokai. Vicki, it's good to be with you.
You and you're our second guest from Hawaii today, so it's good to have you. Now, your book is set in the 19th century in Hawaii. It's a historical fiction book.
Right.
How much is it based on history? How much is it based on history and how much is it based on fiction?
Well, you know, that's a great question because a lot of people will read James Mitcher's book, Hawaii, which was first published in 1959 when Hawaii became a state. And he says right in there that it's all fiction, you know. And when I started down the road to write this book, because this is set in 19th century Hawaii around the time of the overthrow of the monarchy by American missionary descendants. And I thought, I wonder what he, you know, how he dealt with this subject when I was researching it. And his book's about 1,000 pages. And out of that, there's like less than 20 pages where he even references the monarchy or anything that happened in this momentous period. So basically, he ignores it, you know, and I wondered why. But when I did my research, I found that, you know, when the last queen was arrested, they confiscated all of the monarchy's papers and documents, even personal diaries, and kept them under lock and key until well after the queen died, and then in private missionary family collections until well into the 1960s. So Michener didn't have any access to the history that I saw and could read. And I actually wanted to make a concerted effort that the history be as accurate as possible because you all are in Seattle. You know, you have a large Polynesian community mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. So this may not be true of Seattle, but I'll bet you if you go out on the street corner in most any city in the United States and you ask 100 people, how did Hawaii become part of America? Not one in 100 will be able to tell you. Like, say, it might be a little different in your area because you have a lot of Hawaiians and Polynesians. But this is history that's unknown to most Americans, you know, how Hawaii became part of America. So I said, you know, I didn't feel comfortable telling the story through the Queen's eyes, not being Hawaiian. I wouldn't have those deep Polynesian sensibilities to really do that authentically. So I invented some Western characters to help me tell the story who could have lived at the time. But all of the real, you know, cast is in there, the missionary descendants and the Royal Hawaiians. And I was very true to the chronology and really one of the joys of my life is twofold, that Native Hawaiians who read it like it because they think it's a fair treatment of mm-hmm. what really happened, and historians that I've talked to, like at University of Hawaii, that know Hawaiian history, have said it's very historically accurate.
Mm. Now, so you actually, your brother married somebody who's from Hawaii, right?
And that's, well, actually that's Native Hawaiian, yeah.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. that kind of exposed you to things that you just didn't hear of before.
That's right.
And I'll only speak for myself because I didn't know Hawaii had a royal family at all.
That's right.
And I certainly didn't know why it became part of the United States. So what do you hope that people reading this will take away with them?
Well, really, I think that, you know, we get 6 to 7 million travelers here every year, visitors, you know, from other places. And you come from, you know, I guess sounds like England or that part
right,
of the world.
Right,
and
right.
No one would travel to England or Europe and not, you know, take time to read a little bit about the history so they know what they're looking at, you know. But people come here, millions of people come here, and they never scratch the surface because this is such a physically beautiful place, mm-hmm. you know, and they enjoy all of that. But if they dig a little deeper, they're going to find some astounding things in terms of what the actual history of Hawaii was and who the Hawaiians were and are today. And, you know, like my sister-in-law, for instance, who is Hawaiian, her ancestors were from the navigators, the ones who sailed up from southern Polynesia 1,000 years ago. And all her ancestors have star names. And in her family, there's still a stone icon that sat at the front of one of those great sailing canoes. And these were navigators. I mean, you know, when the Europeans were afraid to dip their toes in the Atlantic
right,
for
right.
fear of falling off the edge of the earth, the Polynesians were traversing these vast, thousands of miles of this grand ocean out here and discovering, they were the first discoverers of all these islands. You know, another thing that people don't know, because you, like you said, you didn't know there was a royal family,
mm-hmm.
They were recognized as a sovereign nation by France and England and the United States and many other countries in the world. The last king of Hawaii, Kalakaua, was the first monarch in history to circumnavigate the globe, and he was met with all royal honors in the courts of Asia and Europe, met with the Pope in Rome, met with Queen Victoria, met with the President of the United States. You know, these were statesmen and writers and musicians and, you know, entertaining luminaries such as Robert Louis Stevenson when he passed through the islands, or the Duke of Edinburgh. And so these are things that most people don't know. From Michener's book, you get this idea, oh, they were in grass huts when the missionary arrived, and then they were in grass huts all the way until it became a state.
Right.
Nothing could be further from the truth. They had developed a constitutional monarchy. More than 95% of Hawaiians were literate. I did an event for a literacy group in Houston, and they said that's a percentage that hasn't even been met by most modern countries. So in the 19th century, the Hawaiians were 95% literate. So I just encourage people to look deeper, and it'll give you, this book, The Last Aloha, will give you a view of Hawaii and that you never knew before. It's like coming back to these islands with a complete new vision of who they are.
Yes, and I have to tell you, as a tourist, it makes it more interesting to me now, because I like to look at history when I go different places.
Right.
But why was that history suppressed for almost 100 years?
Well, you know, this was the 19th century, and many countries, especially the European nations and also places like Japan and so forth, were actively involved in grabbing territory. And so, you know, the Germans took Samoa, the French took Tahiti, British in India. It was just going on everywhere, Africa, you know, in the 19th century. Well, Hawaii became kind of a gem, because it's the most remote island group in the world, you know, 2,000 miles from any other land. And so people coming across this way knew how important it was. So little by little, you know, the missionary descendants, unfortunately, you know, a lot of them left the mission field after the Civil War. In the United States, the Board of Missions in Boston couldn't afford to support the missionaries so far away in these little islands, and they told them, you come home and be reassigned to help us with this crisis here in the United States, or you're on your own. Well, you know, you choose Hawaii, you choose Boston. Well, most of them chose to stay here, and they were already third generation by that time. But they, unfortunately, would send their kids back to places like Columbia University. And well, in the 19th century, Columbia University's political science department was based on social Darwinism, that only the Teutonic races had the intelligence for self-rule. So here come these missionary sons back from New York, you know, and first of all, they're imbued with a sense of moral superiority because they're Puritans, and of course, you know, the Polynesians wouldn't measure up to their standards. And secondly, they come back with this now political sense of superiority. They were certainly infected by racial prejudice, being men of their time. And then when the queen ascended the throne after her brother died, you know how it was for women in the 19th century. So
this poor
woman had so many strikes against her, and they just wanted to be associated with the United States. So they did everything they could to demean and dismiss and vilify the queen in order to destabilize the country, in order to make other countries, you know, feel like the Hawaiians couldn't rule themselves, which they were doing very well, thank you.
Right, sounds like it.
And then, you know, just the slander campaign and all of this stuff. And it was so odd because these, you know, these were the Christian folks that were supposed to be abiding by those beautiful teachings of the Christian faith, and they did everything underhanded, whereas the queen, who herself was a Christian, she did. I talked to historians at the University of Hawaii. They say the more they looked at what Queen Liliuokalani did in those days, the more they saw she did everything right, above board, ethical, legal, answered questions worthy of a lawyer, and fought them at every pass with all of the legal ability at her command. But since they did everything underhanded, and eventually through collusion with the U.S. minister here in the islands, illegally landed Marines without the knowledge of the U.S. government to take over, she had no standing army. She couldn't.
Wow.
She couldn't resist.
That was the missionaries that illegally landed the Marines?
Yeah, missionary descendants. By now, they're mostly lawyers.
Go figure.
Yeah, really. But you know, Vicki, this woman, she was, my sister-in-law got me started on this path, right? The sort of this, why doesn't anybody know this history? As I learned from her all these stories I'd never heard, and I've been traveling to the islands since the 1960s. But the queen, when you're going to write a novel, I think as any writer knows, you have to have some very big reasons why you're writing that book in order to finish. It's a long-distance run. The Queen was such an astounding figure because when her back was against the wall and she knew she would lose the kingdom, she made some very profound, what I would call spiritual choices, to preserve the spirit of aloha in these islands and in her people. And Hawaii has a very special spirit, and I think anybody who visits here will tell you that that's so. And I think she transcended the battle. She saw beyond her time. She saw that what was happening in Hawaii with all these different people coming from so many nations and so many places and these clashes that were going on was going to happen in the whole world. And it is happening in the whole world. And I think she understood that if she preserved this spirit, that, you know, the ages would roll around and not the most important things in life cannot always be accomplished in one lifetime. And if the spirit was still here, then there would always be Hawaii. If that spirit had been lost, then it's just another pretty place, you know. So she was such an amazing figure in the choices that she made and how she lived the rest of her life. Mm. And so she was the inspiration, actually. And the book's dedicated to her.
Mm, it is. And I love the cover of the book. I want to take just a second to talk about the artwork on there, because you raised some questions about that. It has poppies on the front. And,
right.
I'll let you tell the story of the cover, but you do raise some interesting questions about that. Was the princess trying to get a message across when she painted this? So talk a little about that, if you would.
Sure. A lot of people look at the cover, you know, and just to describe for your listeners, because they can't see it, they could go later to my website and see it. But anyway, it's a kind of a mountain sloping down in the background with a curve of a bay. And in the foreground are poppies and dandelions painted over. And very sort of a Victorian sort of way of doing it. And this is actually painted by the young Princess Kaʻiulani, who was heir to the throne when she was 15 years old, because she had been sent away to Britain to go to school. And during the time she was away was when all of this turmoil happened and the overthrow of her country. And no one ever told me this, but just knowing the Hawaiians have a tradition they call kauna, which means the deeper meanings. And in their language and in their music, everything has kauna. It has the surface meaning, but then there's meaning and meaning below. And as I looked at this painting, it's really beautiful and quite talented for a 15-year-old, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it, I thought, poppies and dandelions, you know, well, they don't grow in Hawaii, obviously, and she's in Britain. But even though she's probably painting either northern England or the Scottish Highlands, which she also visited, the mountain and the curve of the bay look very much like the iconic Diamond Head and Waikiki area of Hawaii, which was where she lived. And then poppies, of course, are narcotic. You know, they can make you drowsy.
Right.
They can eventually kill you. That's where opium comes from. And dandelions are this noxious weed that propagates itself under the ground and through the air just to cover over everything. And I thought to myself, you know, red and yellow, the poppies and the dandelions, are the color of the ali'i, of the Royal Hawaiians. And I wondered if she was saying, were these Western powers represented by the poppies and dandelions usurping this power of the Royal Hawaiians and just covering over her kingdom? Because as you know, the background is very barren and stark. And it just sort of popped out at me that way. And of course, she never left any record of why she painted it that way, but just sort of knowing the Hawaiian sensibilities and that she was so homesick and that she knew what was going on in her islands just occurred to me that that could be possible.
It could be, and it adds to the mystery. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment already, but I want to just tell us a little bit about the actual book itself and how you built the story.
Sure.
1886, it starts in 1886.
That's right. Like I said, I invented some Western characters who could have lived at the time. And what happens is this young woman, her name is Laura Jennings, she's in San Francisco about to be married. Her family's in a carriage accident, including her fiancé, all killed. So as a 19th century woman, she can't stay alone. So she has to go live with these missionary relatives that she's never met in Honolulu. And she doesn't know where she's going. She thinks she's going to live in a grass hut and minister to savages, right? Because that was the thinking back then.
Right.
But when she arrives in Honolulu, she's totally surprised to find this charming kingdom, a town reminiscent of an earlier day San Francisco. The Hawaiians are not savages. They're very cultured and charming. And then her missionary relatives are now part of the wealthy elite that are trying to overthrow the kingdom. And so her uncle's very controlling. Eventually, to get out of the house, she takes work, first as the governess to this young Kaiulani, the heir to the throne, and later as a lady-in-waiting to Queen Liliuokalani. So she is thrust right into the center of all of the turmoil and intrigue that happens between these two parties, and has her life mixed up with these royal Hawaiians and goes through the whole journey with them.
Yeah, very good story. A lot of intrigue there. And I want to let listeners know about your website, because there's a ton of information up there. And I certainly enjoyed reading about your background. You yourself have an interesting background.
Oh, thank you.
So listeners can find you at GaelenQuinn.com. I'm going to spell that for you. It's GaelenQuinn. Quinn with a double N. So it's GaelenQuinn.com. And there's a ton of information up there, including a blog and some more information about Galen. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Galen?
Well, you know, this story is not only about Hawaii then and now. It's really applicable to all of the things that we're experiencing in the world today, because the theme of the story is really about what values will prevail and what happens when we fail to see the beauty of each other. And Hawaii was an example in a very concentrated space and time of those two things. And so I think it's instructive even for us now, and hopefully will open people's hearts to, you know, the spirit of aloha is to listen with your mind and your heart. And I hope that that's what people will take away.
Well, that sounds great. And I didn't see that you're coming to Seattle anytime soon on book signing. It's hard to get you Hawaiians away.
It's nice over here. Have you come over here, Vicky? You're very welcome. Come over.
I might just take you up on that in a couple of weeks.
All right.
Thank you.
At the airport.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
My guest again, Galen Quinn. You can find more about her at GaelenQuinn.com, her book, The Last Aloha. And coming up next, my next guest was on top of the world. She had a beautiful beachside wedding. She was married to a handsome young man. She'd just got the big promotion she wanted. And 2 weeks later, in her own words, she says a big wind came and changed everything. I'm going to let her share her story in her own words. I'd like to welcome to the show Cami Walker of the 29 Gifts Community. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome, Cami.
Thank you.
So I wanted you to share your journey in your own story, because nobody can tell that better than you. You say, I was watching some video with you, and you say that you can make a lot of grand plans, and one day a big wind can come along and change everything. Tell us what happened to you.
Yes. Well, I returned from my honeymoon, and 3 weeks later, I woke up. It came on very suddenly. I woke up with my hands paralyzed. And 2 days later, I lost my vision in my right eye. And, of course, was rushed to a bunch of specialists and diagnosed with multiple sclerosis very quickly. And it changed everything about our life. My husband, Mark, and I had all these grand plans. We'd be coming back, buying a house, having children, you know, whatever.
Right.
The vision that you have. And, you know, you take your vows in sickness and health, and you don't think that the sickness part will happen 3 weeks later.
3 weeks right? later, right, right.
As a result of my diagnosis, I had to leave my career. I was a creative director in advertising, and at the height of my career at the time. And that was a huge financial blow for us, of course. So we found ourselves, instead of buying a house, moving into a little Cracker Box apartment mm-hmm. in San Francisco, and things went downhill continually for about 2 years for me. And we did move to Los Angeles eventually, because Mark had better career opportunities down here. But I was uprooted from my support system,
right,
of course.
Right.
And the first 4 or 5 months in L.A., I did a tour. I call it the grand tour of the L.A. emergency rooms. And don't recommend it to anyone.
not what we think of when we think of touring L.A., for sure.
No, not at all. And I was hospitalized 4 or 5 times in that period, and was, by that point, having problems walking and was in severe pain. every day, like to the point where I couldn't get out of bed most of the time. And I was checking in for another 8-day hospital stay. It was the night before I was checking in, and I decided to call one of my spiritual advisors.
Now, let me just interrupt a second here. Now, at this point, could you walk? I remember reading some point you couldn't walk.
I could walk with a cane and with assistance.
Okay.
You know, I couldn't walk very far. I probably hadn't walked more than a block for months.
Okay.
At that point.
Okay.
So I was not in good shape, definitely.
Right.
But when I called in Bali, I really called her to have a pity party.
And she's an African medicine woman, as I understand it.
Yes, she's originally from South Africa, lives in the United States now, but was born in South Africa, was raised actually in London. She has a PhD in integrative medicine, but also practices a form of African medicine that it was passed down to her from Maladoma Patrice Somme, who's mm-hmm. a very well-known African shaman. And so she works with people more on a spiritual level now.
Right.
In the past, she's been someone who worked on the body as well, you know. But
Right. Anyway,
I called her that night, started to whine, and she interrupted my pity party and said, "Cammy, you have got to stop thinking about yourself." And I was like, "What do you mean? Who else am I supposed to think about right now?"
Right.
You know?
Right. And it's a perfectly natural reaction for anyone who goes through this kind of thing.
Yeah. I said, what are you talking about, you know? And she said, "I have a prescription for you. I want you to give away 29 gifts in 29 days to other people." And I thought she was nuts. I will just say, I'll be honest. I thought, I was just like, whatever. Like, I can't get out of bed.
Right. And you thought she was so nuts, you did nothing with that for a couple of months,
right? I wrote it down in my journal. I wrote the suggestion down in my journal and promptly closed the journal and put it on the shelf and went into the hospital and came back out of the hospital in still not in good shape, you know. And maybe a month later, I was still feeling very desperate and scared, and I wasn't sleeping that night, and I picked up that journal to write in it, and of course happened to open the page right to where I had written that note, "Give 29 gifts in 29 days." And, you know, it's like there's moments where the universe speaks to you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
right.
For me, that was one of these moments where there was just this awakening happened for me, where I was like, maybe I should just try this. It can't hurt me. You know, like,
right.
It certainly can't hurt me any more than all the steroids and everything they've pumped into me over the last, you know, several months. And so I started that morning. My first gift was a supportive phone call to a friend of mine who also lives with MS. And for me, I hung up the phone feeling happy. And I hadn't remembered feeling happy in months,
mm-hmm.
maybe years, really.
And so these gifts, these 29 gifts that the African medicine, your spiritual mentor told you to give, did not have to be material gifts.
No. It was just about reaching out to someone else every day in some form.
Mm-hmm.
So over the course of those 29 days, I gave mostly very small gifts. I gave like some spare change to a homeless man one day. I gave a Kleenex to a friend who was crying. She was very sad. She had just lost her mother due to complications from MS. I sent my mother tea, you know, like little things. She did suggest that I stretch myself one day. She said at least one of the days during your 29 days, give one gift that it's something that you feel like you can't live without or something that feels scarce in your life. And for me, at that time, it was money. I was very deep in medical debt. And so the biggest gift I gave during that 29 days was a $100 donation to a friend of mine who was leaving for South Africa for a teaching mission. So other than that, which for me, that was a relatively large sum of money at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other than that, all of my gifts were very small things. So
Now, you started documenting what you... Well, first of all, I want to talk about this, because one of the biggest lessons that you've said you've gained from all of this and from the movement that has grown from this, which we'll get to in just a second, but your nature is to want everything planned and organized, and yet you did this in the opposite way to how you used to live your life. You said a big lesson to you was that things fall into place if you get out of your own way. And this has been more of an organic and unplanned kind of thing. And you kind of fought that in the beginning, because I read here that you you documented what you gave away and made notes of any observations you made each day. But you fought this tendency to want to line up all the gifts 29 days in a row.
Yeah, I that was honestly the day. On day two, I remember starting to make a list. And then I was going to line up everything down the hallway. But luckily, I caught myself in the middle of that and realized, wait a minute, that's not the instructions I was given. Right. You know, the instructions I was given were I was supposed to go through every day and just watch for opportunities to make an offering to someone.
And so you started documenting this, and what happened from there?
Well, I began documenting. I threw up a website, very simple website, at 29gifts.org, and I began just blogging about my experience and what I was giving and what I was learning, and keeping notes in a journal as well, because I can't spend more than a couple hours at the computer a day, or I end up in a lot of pain, you know. But that the website, I decided to email 29 of my friends and tell them. It was because by day 14 I was walking without my cane, sometimes as much as like 4, 5, 6 blocks.
Which big was difference.
Huge
big difference.
Progress. And so I around the halfway point, I threw up this website and I emailed 29 friends and said, I've been giving away a gift a day. This is what I've been doing. It was suggested, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I think you should all sign up and try it and document your experience with me. You know, tell me what happens for you as you focus on giving for 29 days. And people started to sign up and try it and started to see changes happening in their lives. So then they began telling friends, and the friends began telling friends. And
it
now
grew.
we have over 6,000 givers in 38 countries.
That's quite amazing. And this all started just from your personal journey and making your personal notes. You've also written a book now.
Yes.
Tell us
yeah.
a little bit about your book. We're almost at the end of our segment, Cami, but if you can tell me in 30 seconds what your book's about.
Well, the book is a memoir that it documents my first 29 days of giving primarily. And then there's a collection of 7 essays in the back from other people who have tried this and seen their lives change. And I think actually the most important part of the book is there's a chapter from Umbali that gives guidance on how to approach this ritual. So the book is a very personal account of what happened for me and the changes that I saw in myself, in my thinking, in my way of being. And it's just nice to also have this collection of short stories from others who have approached it coming from, you know, not coming from a health crisis, but
yeah.
also seeing transformation in their lives.
Yeah, I took a look at your website, and you also, I mean, you're doing some really good work on there, and I'd encourage listeners to check it out and take a look. It's 29gifts.org. Is that correct?
Yeah, the number 29gifts.org.
Yeah, 29gifts.org. And so what would you like listeners to take away with them today?
You know, the biggest lesson that I got out of this is that I learned that as I opened my heart and began to extend my hand to others, what came back to me was everything came back tenfold. And I began to be more open to receiving assistance and help from others. And I learned through this process that I am a small part of a much bigger world.
That's great.
And that we are all connected, and each action we take has an impact on the world.
It does. And I thank you so much for being with us and sharing your journey today. It's very, very inspirational. 29gifts.org is the website, and the book is called 29 Gifts too, right?
Yes, 29 Gifts, How a Month of Giving Can Change Your Life.
Thank you, Cami, for being with us today. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much.
And Cami Walker was my guest, 29gifts.org, her website. Thank you for being with us today. Be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Deepak Chopra says, since change is the only constant in life, it helps to have an expert navigate through the ups and downs of life. And coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, our guest is the expert he's referring to. Adrian D. Bonvoisin specializes in navigating change and will discuss the first 30 days and how to make any change easier. We'll also talk with Dr. Susan Albers about 50 ways to soothe yourself without food. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Hear podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net. Rich a man.